Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents World Keeper, Information is Power, by Justin Miller, narrated by Stephen Bell Davies. Keep listening after World Keeper to hear the story Keeper's World, Days in the Sun. Chapter 1. Converting the three girls into perfect souls was a relatively quick process. Following the conversion itself, the machine stimulated the natural healing process of the soul in order to prevent the occupant from spending hours unconscious as they adjusted to their new states. Instead, the total process took roughly 15 minutes per subject. During that time, James continued to modify the machine any time he sensed a deviation within the flow of fate. Naturally, he wouldn't do this for everyone they converted, as it consumed quite a lot of energy. However, with each modification, the machine became more stable. By the time he was done, James couldn't say that the machine would have a 100% success rate, but it would at least be 90% rather than 87%. Of course, that left the next step. The original perfection chambers were not designed to handle someone with such a firm, solid soul. Thus, they would need to be reconfigured in order to allow those who had reached perfection of the soul to also achieve perfection of the body. Thankfully, James was willing to personally work on this project with the girls, as it meant that he would be able to ensure that Chell would always remain at his side. Sailing through the void of space, a lone Deccan ship explored deeper than it had ever gone before. Like many that had journeyed from the homeland, this was an exploration ship, one looking for new worlds that their people could inhabit with the passing of time. This ship, created with the newest technologies afforded to the allied worlds at the time of its construction, had a sleek appearance that hid its true potential. "Captain, we're about to arrive at the target planet in 5 minutes," a young human spoke up, his smile bright as he looked towards the captain. Unlike some of the other exploration vessels, this one had fully encouraged other races to participate and join its crew. "Understood. Sound the alert and make sure everyone is prepared." When the captain gave that order, she leaned forward, brushing her red hair out of her face. Their deep space scans had indicated that this planet met all the criteria for habitation. Thus, she was excited at the prospect of finding a new world. Another crew member, this one an elven woman, pressed a button before speaking towards her console. "All crew be advised. The Eclipse will be arriving at our destination in 5 minutes. As a precaution, all combat personnel must report to their stations, and all non-combat personnel may enter the safety zones. We will update the situation as needed once we have arrived." As the alert went out, several individuals were forced to stop what they were doing, making their way towards their posts. This was standard procedure for exiting a long warp, as they could never be sure what they would encounter upon their arrival. Thus, most of the crew was rather casual about their preparations, going through it with practiced motions, as they waited to hear the news that it was safe. Within 5 minutes, the ship was at full readiness, the guns fully armed and deployable troops standing by in the hangar. The crew barely felt the jerk of the ship dropping out of warp speed, counting the seconds that passed. However, when the call to stand down was not issued, they began to grow concerned. At the same time, though, there was no call to deploy, leaving them equally confused. Within the bridge, those present all wore dumbfounded expressions as they looked at the display before them. It should be noted that deep space scans could not be activated while in warp, as the intense speed interfered with their energy. Thus, their most recent scan of this planet came from 3 weeks prior. Still, 3 weeks was not a long time when you considered a scale of a planet. Typically, celestial bodies would not undergo any change within such a short amount of time. "Cadet, these are the right coordinates, aren't they?" the captain asked, prompting the navigation officer to check his console again. The human gulped with a nod.
"That's right, Captain."
"Then where's the planet?" Outside the ship, nothing could be seen but a scattered asteroid field floating through the void of space. No planets, no moons, no star. Nothing. Maybe there was a problem with the navigation systems? The cadet offered, before another voice spoke up. This one from a Kitsune male with black hair. I'm getting nothing on the deep scans. Within 10 light-years, all systems have vanished. The nearest star is 13 light-years behind us, and the closest one ahead of us is 115 light-years. The captain furrowed her brow at that. Send an emergency notice back to the homeworld. We might have another incident, like the Mitong. I want immediate scans of this system. Any traces of energy should be reported. Understood. The Kitsune nodded, adjusting the scanner to focus on their current system. I'm picking up trace amounts of mana, though they are fading. There were living creatures here within the last 18 hours. Aside from that, heavy dimensium signatures, thousands of times above normal concentration. The captain thought about that for a moment, looking like she was about to speak. However, before she could, the Kitsune gave another report. Captain, I'm picking up what appears to be debris from an artificial construct among the wreckage. The captain's face went stern at the news. Show me. At her command, a screen displayed in front of her, showing her a large piece of worked metal, dented and scorched, floating among the asteroids. It looked like it had simply fallen off of whatever it was previously attached to. However, its presence here, along with the energy readings, confirmed that this was the work of another spacefaring vessel. Send that report. Request confirmation from the March that they have not journeyed into this sector. The only races aside from the Kitsune that should have had access to such deep space in this realm were the March and the Mitong. The Mitong ships were composed of liquid metal, so a warped metal plate like this obviously did not belong to them. Philia sat within a large terrace, hanging beneath the highest branch of a mighty tree. This was the area she had created for herself for contemplation. By now, all of her sisters had left the mother tree, and it would no longer bear any fruit. Its life was sustained by those it had given birth to, but its spirit had been depleted. With the other sisters having already left to establish their own colonies, Philia was the only one left to govern this colony, watching as the nature of her people seemed to change. When the spirit of the tree died, it lost its ability to serve as a host for its people's knowledge. It could not even be used to act as a hub for communication. After centuries of sharing one mind, the lower ranks of the Sylvans had been cut off. The tree survived for 900 years in total, with most of its children having survived until this point. Those who were first born were showing signs of age, their leaves wilting and joints stiffening.
So, this is what becomes of us when the mother tree perishes? Philia asked herself, gazing at the forest below.
The blue Sylvans had it better. They were used to thinking creatively. After getting past their initial shock, they were able to use natural energy and ki to restore some of their youth. The red Sylvans were used to following orders, thus making it easy for the blues to rally them into a peacekeeping force. The real problem was the greens, which were the vast majority of the population. Their minds were simpler, more prone to panic after being cut off from the collective. They were the caretakers of the forest, the workers that kept everything alive. When they stopped, the forest began to die around them. Although they did their best in their panic to revive the forest, they no longer had the coordination to properly divide their tasks. Every month that passed, Philia watched more of the forest die. She had done her best to help, using her divine power to open connections between different parts of the forest. But without being connected to the collective, the green Sylvans failed to understand what she wanted. They thought that they were being told to focus on one single section until orders were given to move again. At this point, Philia was forced to acknowledge just how primitive her people were as a species. They had never been through a situation like this, and thus had no way of overcoming it.
In the future, I should advise the others to rely less on the collective mind. Save that for the blue children.
She nodded her head at that thought,
slowly rising. The primary problem here was in how their civilization was raised. They took advantage of the tree and became dependent on it. None of them knew what would happen when the last fruit fell from its branches. Playing it out in her mind, Philia knew that their race would be able to continue after the tree fell, as long as they did not panic. Those who had reached the end of their lifespans would be preserved much as the Blue Sylvans had done for themselves. The only thing that would be lost was the collective mind. Philia walked to the edge of her terrace, seeing how the death of the forest would soon arrive at the great tree. "Children of the forest," she spoke, projecting her voice out into the minds of all within the forest. "Return to the mother tree, and I shall take us to a new grove. It is too late for us to save this home, so we shall aid another in its growth." Of those that heard her call, many were left shocked. They were being told to abandon the forest that they had spent centuries tending, the home that they had all built together as one collective. Not only the Greens, even the Blue Sylvans had a hard time accepting this. Only the Reds obeyed without questioning the order, turning and walking towards the tree at the heart of the forest. Their dismissal from their earlier acts caused more confusion from the ranks of those that had been patrolling. But this was all that Philia could do. Without being able to re-educate them all from the beginning, the only hope for their survival was to enter a new grove. There they would be able to learn the proper way to survive, and gradually rid themselves of the innate flaws that Philia had discovered. It was sad, but there was no way for her to save the tree which had given birth to her. Its spirit had already departed, so she could only offer it a fond farewell. As she felt the Red Sylvans closing in, as well as those from the other classes that had answered her call, she closed her eyes. Over the years, she had given birth to 9 daughters herself, sending them to 9 worlds to become 9 new trees. When each of these trees was born, Philia felt an instinctive connection to it, one that crossed the boundaries of space. With just a thought, she could reach out and touch the branches of any of these trees, as if they were all connected. And whenever she did so, it would cause a golden gateway to open before her, one that led directly to the tree she was focusing on. This, she imagined, was the true power belonging to a Sylvan god, the power to connect every branch that came from them together to form a true world tree. When the first of the Sylvans arrived before her, she focused on one of her more developed children, deciding that she would first correct their upbringing before visiting the others. This was a matter which would take a great deal of time, but was one that she must accomplish to ensure the prosperity of her people. Chapter 2. It did not take long for a response from Deccan to reach the Eclipse. The response, while at first not outside of their expectations, soon completely surpassed anything that they could imagine. As they had thought, the march had not been to this region of space yet. They would have had no reason to destroy so much territory, so the captain had doubted it was them in the first place. What surprised them was the fact that Deccan responded that they knew who the opposing party was, and because of that knowledge they ordered a full retreat. The Eclipse was recalled due to the enemy's overwhelming power. This was an order that came directly from the God Queen, so the Eclipse did not even consider disobeying. They immediately activated their recall feature to return to Deccan's system. Not only them, every ship that had gone in the same general direction as they had was being ordered to return. Far across the empty void of space, a giant planet drifted. Numerous thrusters propelled the planet, allowing it to move at a high speed. Within the planet there were no oceans, no forests, or meadows. Only a single massive forge that spanned the entirety of the planet, both inside and out. "Reporting to the Lord Sovereign," a clockwork soldier stepped forward, the gears in its chest clicking as they turned. The figure that the soldier addressed was, to call it massive would not do it justice.
Even seated atop its throne, the being it spoke to was several kilometers tall. The former head of the Gears' research and development within their homeland, and the new sovereign of the current realm. There was a long period of silence after the soldier spoke, but it did not seem to pay it any mind. Eventually, a voice echoed out from high above.
"Have the stellar forges been prepared?"
The voice was an odd mix of two different voices, one harsh and the other serene. "As you have ordered, all stars within 100 light-years have been converted," the soldier reported reverently, after which another moment of silence passed. However, within the head of the giant ruler, there were two voices holding a discussion. One of these voices was represented by a blue wisp, its voice gentle and flowing.
"Now that we have the forges, it should be time to prepare the next step. Should we continue expanding our forces here, or begin the campaign?"
The other voice was represented by a red wisp, its voice harsh and angry.
"Clearly we have to strike while the iron is hot. Who knows how far that fool Gear has gone in all this time? With the stellar forges backing us, we should be able to easily conquer the homeland, god or not."
The blue wisp fell silent at that, seeming to think it over.
"However, we only have one chance at this. If anything happens..."
"Oh, that guy will definitely kill us," the red wisp laughed, madly. "But that's what this is. Either he dies or we do. This is what we've been waiting for all along."
As the blue wisp was about to speak up, another voice spoke, this one coming from outside the sovereign's mental space.
"Reporting to the Lord Sovereign,"
the two voices spoke at once, the sovereign itself matching their question.
"Another one? What is it?"
The second soldier that had arrived quickly knelt down before the mountainous figure. "Our long-range scans have detected traces of another spacefaring race within this realm. The energy residue suggests that they are using ships to traverse the stars." The blue wisp appeared thoughtful at that.
"Another race? It has been so long. I had almost given up hope of finding any truly intelligent life on this side of the dimensional wall."
"Huh." The red wisp was pleased by this discovery. "You wanted to wait and build up our forces, right? What better way than this? Once we assimilate their technology, there's sure to at least be some increase in our power. At the very least, we can test the fleet."
The blue wisp thought it over, before doing something similar to a nod. Afterwards, the giant sovereign again spoke in its dual-tone voice.
"Prepare the God-Slayer fleet. Find the traces of these aliens, and track them back to their homeworld."
"At once, Lord Sovereign." The two soldiers responded immediately, before turning and running away to execute their orders.
"Well, that's not very good," I muttered, looking at the factory planet of the Gears as it sailed through space. Behind the factory planet were far more ships, some even larger. However, the biggest structure that they had built was one which they were unable to bring with them. Rather, in the region they had left was a truly enormous construction, one which linked dozens of stars together, each surrounded by a full sphere of metal. The energy and heat from these stars were gathered, used to power the fleet through the effect of a fourth-tier spell. These were the Stellar Forges, so large that they had to move entire stars to complete the project. Sitting next to me, Behenna furrowed her brow. It was one of the odd moments when she chose to join me in the living room, so I had been projecting what I was seeing to the television.
"If they turn all of that power into a weapon, is there anything that the people down there can do to stop it?" she asked, with uncertainty, seemingly able to measure the energy within the Stellar Forge.
"Tsubaki might have a way to resolve it with her domain. Aside from her, I don't even know if James would survive a blast from that." I shook my head, unable to offer a better answer. They had built that fleet with the idea of fighting a god in mind. Most likely, this was the same fleet that Fisher had seen in his dream.
The primary difference here was that they had more warning of the impending attack. And with that warning, they could prepare countermeasures. Udana was not so uncaring that she would hold this information back from them, after all.
"What's that?" James asked in surprise as he listened to the request coming in from the God Queen herself.
"That kind of power? How is the progress of your new warships?" On the screen, Udana shook her head bitterly. "Aside from the prototype, the rest won't be ready in time to sortie. And I'd rather not take on a fleet of this scale with one ship, regardless how powerful its potential may be."
"Understandable, completely understandable." James gave a small nod.
"I suppose there isn't a candidate available to quickly become a god of manufacturing to speed up production?"
"I'd have to ask Acalia, but I doubt it. Do you not have any other solutions?"
There was a tone of concern in Udana's voice as she asked that, to which the former keeper chuckled.
"I do, but those would have been the easiest. Let's see. I'll need you to send me all of the details about the enemy that you can. The sooner I have it, the better I'll be able to plan."
At that, Udana was finally able to let a small smile creep its way onto her face.
"Have you forgotten? I'm the goddess of education."
After saying such, she closed her eyes, and James felt a stream of knowledge entering his mind all at once.
"Whoa!" He brought a hand up to his head reflexively. "Now that's a rush. Okay, if this is all accurate, I can have a countermeasure prepared within a month.
How long did you say that it would take them to get here?" Udana's face fell slightly at that.
"A month."
"Then I should have plenty of time," he grinned, the tight deadline only seeming to spur him on further.
"Sorry, goddess, but it seems I've got work to do." He abruptly cut off the line, spinning in his chair.
"Chell, we're restarting Project Heartbreaker."
Chell, standing on top of the Perfection Chamber, blinked as she heard that. She furrowed her brows, focusing to dig through her memories so that she could remember exactly which project he named that.
"Wait, the defensive one, or the—"
No, the defensive one," James cut her off abruptly, not wanting her to mention the other Project Heartbreaker.
"Are you sure? This world doesn't seem to have the technology for that kind of project,"
Chell mentioned, hesitantly, looking around as if their lab would only prove her point.
"And that's what makes it exciting," he grinned broadly.
"Get Tsubaki on the line. We'll be using geometric magic to replace the missing components. Aside from that," he rubbed his hands together, excitement in his eyes,
"it's time to ramp up production."
Chell blinked before letting out a helpless groan. "And he's in full automation mode now. Guess I should just take care of my part then." She shook her head, hopping down from the machine and walking over to a terminal. After dialing a number, she smiled at the kitsune that appeared on the screen.
"Tsubaki? Hey, it's me. Sorry for the sudden call, but James wants your help with a project. Wait, what's with that expression?"
Chell's eyes went wide as she saw the color drain from Tsubaki's face.
"I promise this won't be anything like the last time, okay? We really just need your help for, like, a month, tops? Maybe as little as a week. Oh, and bring Dana, too," she added, almost as an afterthought. "We need the brightest minds we have for geometric magic.
There's some big bad that's approaching one of our worlds, and we don't have all the technology we need here to stop them."
Tsubaki's eyes instantly regained their focus at that, her expression hardening. Despite her aversions to James and her desire to avoid prolonged projects for a little while, the news that there was danger approaching on such a scale forced her attention to the task at hand.
"Understood. I'll get the two of us ready. Is there anything else that I should know?"
Chell thought it over for a moment before responding. "James is currently in one of his little episodes right now. He won't bother you much, even if you show up looking how you normally do. The project we have to work on is really big, so he's planning a fully automated production line for it."
Tsubaki nodded, looking slightly relieved at that, before Chell spoke again.
"Also, he is really bad at naming things." The kitsune goddess looked suddenly confused when she heard that, but slowly nodded her head once again.
"I See? Anyways, we'll be over in a few minutes. Let me just make sure we have everything we need first. Chapter 3.
When Tsubaki and Dana arrived at the research facility, they were greeted by Chell, who was currently the lone occupant of the lab. At least, the lab that existed on Deccan.
"I'll take you to where we're working now," she said with a smile, guiding the two inside and towards a silver door.
As the door opened, the two of them saw a far larger lab, seemingly cut off from the world. As powerful beings in their own right, they were able to sense the faint fluctuations in the air and how they were different on either side of the door. This was particularly so for Dana, who owned all of the darkness in this world. According to her senses, there should have been nothing behind the door but an empty wall, yet they were able to walk through it. There they saw the rest of James's research team gathered around a large table, staring at a blueprint.
"We can't really make something like this, can we?"
the elven researcher asked, her eyes wide in disbelief.
"The researcher seems to believe that it is possible," the golem spoke,
though it was unclear if his confidence was in their abilities or simply in their boss's judgment.
"What are they talking about?" Dana asked,
moving over to take a look. What she saw was a design for some sort of satellite dish, though it was hard to tell exactly what purpose it held.
"That?" Chell grinned, walking up to the table and leaning against it. "Is the core of Project Heartbreaker. We're going to need 6 of them in total, so he's working on assembly lines right now."
"Okay, so what does it do?"
The little elven spirit clearly wasn't able to see whatever the research team could see from the blueprint. The schematics she typically dealt with were of the magical variety. Chell let out a chuckle at the question, gazing around at the lab they were in. Project Heartbreaker was a theory that he came up with a long, long time ago. An ultimate defense, one that would break the heart of anyone trying to siege a planet. The principle is quite simple, but implementing it is anything but. Essentially, we create a barrier around the entire planet, and then force everything in that barrier to be just slightly out of phase with the rest of the world. A foot in the door of the void, as it were, isolating it from any attacks that would come our way. Tsubaki furrowed her brow as she thought about that. An attack launched from outside the barrier would pass through the world as if it were a simple illusion? Chell snapped her fingers, pointing to Tsubaki.
"Right. But this isn't just an illusion. If it were, there are way easier ways to do it. Creating an illusion of a planet isn't that difficult with the right know-how. Turning a planet into an illusion? Trickier, but still doable."
The reason that this was only ever a theory for James was because it requires void folding on a massive scale, and we didn't have a power source capable of sustaining something like that for more than a few seconds. Unfortunately, while we didn't have the power source, you guys are lacking a lot of the essential components to make this work, meaning that we'll need to substitute magic for the missing pieces. Tapping her fingers on the table, a holographic projection appeared, hovering over it and displaying what the satellite would look like when it was completed. "I'll provide you with a list of components that we need to have replaced and what their functions are. Your job will be to create magical versions of the parts we need. If you want to use geometric, runic, or even card magic, it's fine, as long as the end result achieves our goal. According to the strategy, we'll need to power these satellites for at least 2 hours. Each one will require at least 4 of your orbs to keep up with the consumption needed." Chell nodded toward Tsubaki as she said that, only to be cut off by her elven co-worker.
"Wait, wait, wait," the elven researcher shook her head in confusion. "If we encapsulate the planet in this void shield and take it out of phase with this world, that's going to do a lot more than just make us invulnerable to attacks, you know. Deccan's gravity won't have a hold on the moon anymore at that point, causing it to escape orbit. And even our planet could potentially drift out of its orbit if we are forced to hold this shield long enough."
Chell nodded in complete agreement with those assumptions. "I mean,
You're not wrong. Heartbreaker was never meant for long-term usage, and is simply a last resort to stall for time until reinforcements arrive.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?